You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another podcast episode. In this episode, we are going to be talking about 1031s. So I've got Chris Sayer here with me, who has over 24 years of experience and close to 10,000 deals under his belt as a qualified intermediary helping other people do 1031 exchanges. So Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, close to 10,000 deals is just the first thing that pops out, like, wow, that's impressive. So how did you get into doing the, you know, being a 1031 guy? I never remember seeing that on my college job, you know, boards I used to give you. Like, how'd you get into this field?
You know, Chris, I have a friend who's an attorney. His name is Steve Hickox. He's my partner in this business. He started doing this about 26 years ago as part of his attorney practice, doing exchanges. And he came to me and said, you know, I have a good idea. Let's market this thing and make a go of it. And I basically did some calculation on the equivalent of a cocktail napkin and figured out it wasn't going to cost us much to decide that we were going to do this. And the company kind of trickled along for a few years. And then we started to market better and better, and it grew into a real business over about a 2.5-3 year time frame from 1994 when I first got involved in the company. No, 92, sorry.
And I imagine the landscape for 1031s has changed quite a bit over the last 20 years, or I don't know. I don't know. Has it?
It really hasn't. Probably the most significant changes have happened really in the wake of the new tax code.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened with the new tax code was that you're not allowed to do personal property exchanges anymore. So that means the few exchanges that we did in the area of trading helicopters or trading planes, rolling stock is like tractor trailers, that kind of thing, and art, collector cars, you can't exchange that anymore.
Well, you had mentioned the story as we were talking a few days ago. I think it was either Ferrari or Lamborghini. It was very interesting about the deal that you helped you. Like, what was that?
Well, it's one of my favorite stories. And unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do these because this is personal property. Well, but we had a client look us up online, found us, Googled us, and needed to do a 1031 exchange. He lived in Hawaii, and his daily driver in Hawaii, he lived in Honolulu. And a car broker came to him and said, I know you have this very rare Ferrari that you're driving around. I have a buyer for this car. And this guy was smart enough to say, well, I like cars. I don't want to pay the tax on this. I'm going to trade properties. And I know that the easy way to do this would be to sell it and you escrow the funds, do a 1031 exchange involving my car, and I'm going to buy 3 replacement Ferraris. And he did that. So it's my favorite story, but unfortunately, we're not going to be doing it anymore. So.
And you say the changes, that's the recent changes that President Trump passed a while back? Okay.
Correct.
So just so everyone understands that there, because you know, in the real estate investing world, you see 1031s a lot of time, you hear about it a lot of time, but give us the details on how it works. Explain it, you know, explain what it is just so everyone understands what a 1031 is.
Well, a 1031 exchange is, well, in broader terms, I like to think of it as an interest-free loan from the government. It's the ability to trade appreciated property for more appreciated other property, investment property. And that allows you to defer the capital gains tax on the sale. So it's reported almost like it's actually a trade, as if it was a bunch of people sitting at a table trading properties back and forth simultaneously. Well, 1031 allowed for non-simultaneous exchanges. You go through a company like mine and you can report a trade rather than a sale and a repurchase. This is tax code gobbledygook, but it's important because it's hard to actually have a trade that you can do between people. You know, I want to sell my little property and I want somebody else's little property, and you're just not necessarily going to be able to trade straight up.
Yeah.
So this is a way of putting a buffer between you and your transaction so that it's not reported as a 1031 exchange.
So it sounds like, let's just say I own a house, you own a house, we're both rental properties, are both worth around $300,000. We could just do a straight trade and not have to pay taxes on it if it's just between you and me.
Yes,
and worked it out ourselves.
You can do that. You can do that, but it's hard to do.
Yeah.
And there are rules that are applied to doing this. So a lot of times we're actually brought into that kind of transaction just to make sure that it happens seamlessly.
Because that's an expensive mess up if you don't get it right.
It is a very, very rule-driven piece of the tax code.
So before we dive into more details about how 1031 works, just so we understand kind of the savings people can give. So let's use a round number of like $1 million. Let's say a client here has an apartment building they can sell for $1 million even.
Mm-hmm.
If they don't do a 1031, and it's in the state of Colorado, if they don't do a 1031, like what's the capital gains implications on there as far as how much would they owe off that $1 million, real roughly?
Okay. You've given me a piece, which is what they're going to sell it for.
Mm-hmm.
We need to kind of delve into what the cost, what this taxpayer has purchased the property for.
Let's just say they bought 30 years ago for $100,000 to give us some nice big money to play around
okay.
with.
Okay. So if they bought for 30 years ago from 30 years ago, I'm not going to get too much in the weeds on this, but that property has been depreciated to nothing
mm-hmm.
over that time period. So they have depreciated approximately $90,000 in the building over that time period. So all that's left in the residual value on that property is land cost, which is 10% of the original purchase price, just for argument's sake, of $10,000.
Okay.
So that client is potentially on the hook for all of that $1 million.
And they'd have to pay Colorado capital gains, right?
Well, first and foremost, they're going to owe recapture of depreciation tax on that $90,000 that we just talked about.
Okay.
And that's approximately 25% for Fed and 5% for state. I may not have that figure exact, but it's close enough.
Yeah, I just want a ballpark to understand of like what we're doing. So about 30%. Recapture depreciation tax
on $90,000
that we depreciated from the original purchase price.
So take that $90,000 out of the equation. Now the remaining, let's for argument's sake, call it $100,000 and say the remaining $900,000 will now be called capital gain.
Okay.
So the capital gains tax on the federal level is 15% and 5% for the state capital gains. So that's 20% of $900,000 or $180,000 in tax spread over Fed and state.
So $180,000 for capital gains plus about $30,000 recapture.
Mm-hmm.
So we were looking at we'll just say 200,000 to keep exactly. it simple. So that's a good chunk of change.
That's the definition of a tax, isn't it?
Yeah.
A transaction tax.
So obviously that's the reason why people are interested in 1031s, because they get to defer both the capital gains and the depreciation recapture.
Mm-hmm.
So no taxes whatsoever.
Yep.
Okay.
And that only works in this case if you sell for $1 million and buy for $1 million. Now, that's net of some transaction fees. So your title insurance fee, realtor commission, my fee, if you hired me, comes out off of the top of that to arrive at an adjusted fair market value. So you have a little smaller hurdle rate as far as achieving a successful exchange.
And what are the timeline rules? So I sell this property. What's the basic timeline? Because I know that's where the devil's in the details, right?
Absolutely. Very rule-driven, hard and fast rules. Unless there's some kind of an act of Congress, you're going to have to, the day that you sell your relinquished property, the million-dollar property that we were talking about, is day zero. You have 45 complete, continuous, consecutive days to identify the simple rule up to three properties. These are your replacement property target properties that okay. you're identifying. 45 days to identify. As of the 45th day, your identification is set in stone. That's that, unless there's an act of Congress. Oh, I'm buying replacement property in Florida and they had a hurricane and Congress acted to extend the ID period. And that's happened a few times, but as difficult as it is to try and get legislation through Congress, I wouldn't hang my hat on that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would never rely on hoping Congress passes something.
Correct. Yeah. It sounds like you're from DC, so you know yeah. about this more than anybody else.
So. Yeah. So, okay. So up to, you said up to three properties, right? I want to really get in the details on here. So,
absolutely.
Okay. So if I have my $1 million I have to place for my previous example, mm-hmm. what if I want to buy four $250,000 homes?
You can do that. It's okay. You're operating on, and this is, we're getting back to kind of government gobbledygook here, basically. ID rule A is up to three properties. You can identify as many, three properties, no restrictions on value or anything like that. ID rule B is the 200% rule. So you can identify, and don't mix these rules up. They stand on their own completely.
Okay.
So 200% rule in this case is you can identify as many properties as you would like, as long as the aggregate value of the identified replacement properties is not worth more than 200% or two times the value of the property that you sold.
So I can identify as many properties as I want, as long as it's not more than $2 million in this fictitious
Correct.
Example.
Correct.
Okay. Now, what happens if I identify, let's say, those four properties and three just don't happen? They follow a contract for whatever reason because, you know, inspection shows the foundation's horrible and I don't want it. Like, am I stuck with those properties?
You've got to make them work if you're going to show a fully tax deferred exchange. Okay. In some cases, if you are only going to close on one of the three properties, a partially tax deferred exchange would be what you ended up having. And that may, well, in the case of our example, as we talked about, because there's no basis anymore in the property, it would help you some, but you would owe tax to the degree that you traded down in value. So let's say you only bought 250 worth of replacement property and you needed to buy a million. Well, you would owe the taxes on the $750,000 that you traded down in value.
So that 45-day mark is incredibly important to make sure not only you've identified the properties, but ideally, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you've got them under contract and you know there's no major issues that would make you want to kill the deal.
Yeah, I like to see, particularly in an environment like this, I like to see my clients shopping and really understanding the lay of the land as far as what they're trying to purchase. And that may mean getting something under contract, you know, having some kind of pocket listing or, you know, some kind of edge to making sure that you can be successful in this transaction.
Okay. So we get to the 45-day mark. What's the next milestone?
The next milestone as of the 45th day is that now you have 135 additional days to close on any or all of your identified properties. So the way the rule reads is 45 days and 180 days to close. And those time periods run concurrently.
Okay.
But I'd like to make it very clear that it's not 45 plus 180. The 45 overlaps with the 180 close rule.
Okay. So you just have to get the properties closed on in that remaining 135-day period.
Correct.
And it has to be the properties that you identify. There's no switcheroos there
no
allowed.
No switcheroos.
There's no magic up your guys' sleeve that allowed a switcheroo?
No.
Okay.
I hate to say it. I mean, there are a lot of people who have tried to come up with this, and I just haven't. The problem is that when you report a 1031 exchange following the tax year in which you've had done an exchange, you have to file an 8824 form. And this is a particularly, it's an interesting form because it helps you, it captures your basis in the old property and helps you calculate your new basis in the new property. But it also puts you in a box as far as perjuring yourself if you haven't done everything according to the rules.
And that's where you get into trouble then is
correct.
The perjury.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Because if you perjure yourself, now you've perpetrated a fraud.
Yeah. That's
and that's not
federal.
An area where you want to go. So.
And to make this all work, when I sell my $1 million whatever, does the money come sit in my checking account? Like what happens to the proceeds? Like what are kind of the details on here?
Well, we have to, as QI, deny you access to your funds. If you have beneficial receipt of the funds, meaning you take the check and you put it in your checking account, you have recognized that gain.
Okay.
As far as the government goes. So we end up banking the funds for you in a dedicated account for you, holding them for instructions and purchase of your replacement property. So you have to be denied access to your funds. And that's one of the things that we do besides consult is we provide an escrow function for you that is mandated by the IRS.
And so how is the seller how is their money safeguarded from the QIs out there? There's, you know, because there's some people dip or borrow the money. Like how is a seller protected? I just don't understand like that level of detail.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are mandated by the state of Colorado to open dedicated accounts for our clients that only have their funds in them. And then we have to show written instructions signed by our client to disperse the funds. So we are denied access to their funds.
So you have to show the bank a written authorization.
You have to show the bank
okay.
that our client is signing off and has given instructions as far as what they are intending to do with their funds.
Okay. Very. That makes a lot of sense.
It's one of the reasons why if you're not going to do business with me in doing an exchange, choose a qualified intermediary who's in Colorado because of this protection.
Oh, so a lot of states don't have a slumber protection?
They're allowed to commingle funds if they want.
So is it just Colorado with this?
I believe it's just Colorado.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. So what are some common mistakes that you see people make that just screw up the 1031?
Well, there's not IDing properly within 45 days. That's probably the biggest one.
Well, can you talk about, is it just as simple as saying, I want to buy property A, B, and C, or do they have to fill out certain paperwork, get them under a contract?
We have a form that's part of the process. It's part of the paperwork that we provide to our client is an identification form that's okay. simple. It's got three different lines on it for addresses, and you fill out the form. You send it to us within 45 days. It becomes part of your file.
And do they have to do three, but they can do less or more, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. But if they're going to do more, we need to talk to them because we need to inform them properly about the 200% rule. And then there's another rule, which is crazy, and maybe we can get into it later, but it's
well, now that you mentioned it, we'll have to at some point. So.
I know. It's the identity. And again, forget about rule A, rule B. And now we're in the land of rule C. And that's, I'm going to trade down and buy a whole bunch of little tiny properties. And I'm going to identify a whole bunch of them. But now I have to successfully close on 95% of the value of those identified properties. Close.
Say that again. I think I understand you. So 95%. So if I buy my four homes.
I'm going to buy 20 lots that are worth $50,000 each.
Okay.
I have to close on at least 19 of those lots to have a successful exchange.
And is it like an all or nothing? Like if you don't, the whole exchange gets wiped out then?
All or nothing.
Okay.
That's terrible.
Wow.
But we've had maybe two or three people who have used that ID rule C in the 10,000-ish exchanges that we've done over 25 years. So I try not to muddy the waters with this rule. So yeah, you can listen to it, but forget about this rule. And
yeah.
And if you're going to buy a whole bunch of little development lots and that's what you're going to do, we should talk. But otherwise, forget about this. ID three properties or the 200% rule. Most of the time is the issue. So
okay. So what are some other common mistakes that people make?
I mean, I think what you're referring to is the misconceptions about what people can do with their properties.
Yes, you're right. So I mean, you know, you've got you handle so many deals, you know, mm-hmm. the common questions people have. So just, you know, start running through those because I'll have those questions. Our listeners have those questions. Like, what are the common questions, misconceptions that people do have?
Sure. Well, the one that we get a lot is that people, they think that they need to do a 1031 on their primary residence. That's not the case unless they've, you know, used their property in some way as an investment property. And it's really more investment property than it is their primary residence. There's a much more favorable piece of tax code called Section 121, which deals with primary residence dispositions. And that is, you can put, as a married couple filing jointly, you can put $500,000 of gain in your pocket without doing any kind of exchange on the sale of your primary residence. And that, I would have to say, is the best deal going in real estate. It's why small investors or homeowners should own their own property, is because that's an excellent piece of tax code that, that allows you to pocket a huge amount of money. $500,000 is a good size chunk of change for most people.
Very good size chunk of change.
Exactly. So people should buy real estate, and hopefully it'll go up in value and you'll be able to take advantage of this piece of the tax code. And then you can take some of that money and invest wherever it is, stock market, more real estate, and build their wealth that way. You're in charge of your own destiny in terms of your future and your family's future. And these are very favorable kind of taxpayer-friendly laws that help people out. And I encourage people to take advantage of these pieces of the tax code that are going to help you as a small investor.
What about like vacation homes and second homes?
You know, vacation homes and second homes fall in squarely in this in-between thing that I just think is not favorable to the taxpayer, because you cannot write off anything in the area of a second home. You can't defer the taxes in any way. It doesn't fall under 121.
Okay.
It doesn't fall under Section 1031 because it's not investment property. I encourage people to use their second homes and vacation homes to the degree that they can as investment property.
Like, what would designate as an investment property versus vacation home then? Like, what would be, if someone wanted to
show rental income, show some kind of rental income. The rule is that you can't use it more than 2 weeks or more than 10% of the total use of the property that, you know,
that the owner can't use personally.
Well, here's the thing is that to maintain the property, if you are maintaining the property, that use that you do when you are fixing it up, making repairs, cleaning it, that kind of thing, doesn't count as your personal use. And nobody's really checking on this. There's no mechanism for checking how much personal use you have. I happen to have two different vacation rental properties that I use myself. And I should have done this long ago, because you get income from the property. You can write off expenses on the property. It's just the way you should go until you decide, I'm going to begin to use this property as my personal residence, 121.
Okay.
So I like to see people not report properties as either second homes, or if they're going to use it as a second home, that they use it enough that they can show a big portion of their time being spent there so that they can begin to tick off, oh, well, I was down at my place in Phoenix for 4 months. And then the next year I was there for another 4 months, and sort of add up those months so that you can show personal 121 use of the property, or show investment income, rental income.
So you really want to either one bucket, the personal residency bucket or the investment property bucket.
That's what I like to see. Yes.
I mean, that makes sense. I've never heard described that way. That makes a lot of sense to me.
It's my approach to real estate, second home type real estate.
Now, with the recent changes in the tax law from a few months ago, I know 1031 says like kind property to like kind. So only real estate to real estate, or what can or can't you do?
It's interesting because when you delve into, some of my clients are well read and they go in and they look at stuff on the internet and they see this like-kind designation, like it's some sort of, you know, magic thing that, oh, well, and they read incorrectly into it that, oh, if I'm selling a single family home, I've got to buy more of the same. That's not the case. In this case, it's investment real estate for more investment real estate. So that means it can be anything. You can sell your single family property and buy condos. You can sell your condos and buy raw land. You can sell raw land, trade back into a single family residence. And in some cases, you can sell real estate and buy oil and gas properties.
But can I sell real estate and buy a Ferrari?
No.
Okay. So any other common I got some more questions here, but any other common kind of like questions you get from clients before I shift gears here into some other questions I got for you?
Well, some of these are, and let me look at my cheat sheet here. I guess it would be two different things. One is that some clients feel that by doing an exchange, they reset their basis in their property, in the property that they're selling. That's not the case. You carry forward your old basis into the new property, and then to the degree that you traded up in value and had to pay more money, that gets added to the new basis.
Can you give us some examples with some real, you know, even rounded numbers?
Sure. Let's get back to our $1 million example.
Okay.
And say, all right, I have no basis in that property at all, but I sold that property and I decided, well, I found something that I really like that's worth $1.2 million. So now I either have to get a loan for the remainder of the funds that I need to close on that property, or I bring more cash to the table to buy that property. Well, that extra $200,000 that I've spent on real estate, and in this case, in this example, becomes my new basis in the property.
So my new basis is now
$200,000.
Okay.
On a $1.2 million property. So that means if I sell that property for cash after I buy it, say I decided, oh no, I made a mistake, I don't want to buy it. I just want the cash. I don't want any more real estate. I'm just going to cash out. Now you're going to owe the tax on that $1 million that you traded down or out, didn't have any replacement property that you purchased. So the government keeps this as this kind of little, we're going to keep track of what your gain is so that when you decide to sell for cash, we're going to get our tax dollars from you. So the basis doesn't reset.
Now, I've heard, I'm not sure where, but what happens in that example and I die and my kids inherit that property? Because the basis currently gets stepped up, so they would no longer have that $200,000 basis. Now they get like one of the best tax advantages in the world, and now they get the basis at 1.2 or fair market value whenever
Correct.
I go?
Correct. The new property, so you trade into a $1.2 million property, you die, your heirs get your property, they get the stepped up basis. So their new basis is revalued as of the date of death. So you get an appraisal, it's worth 1.2, they can do with it what they want. They can sell it, and if it hasn't gone up in value, they will owe no tax.
Wow. That's another nice tax benefit there.
Yeah, you have to do is die to avoid taxes. You know, and it all just comes back to death and taxes, doesn't it?
It does. So I know there's different types of exchanges that QIs can do. I've heard reverse exchange a lot. Like, what is a reverse exchange?
A reverse exchange is something that works really well in the market that we currently find ourselves in. And that is, you are going to have to close on your replacement property before you sell your relinquished property. And the reason why this works is because in a seller's market like this, you're just not going to find very many patient sellers who are willing to wait to close on a deal because you need to sell or fix up your relinquished property before you can perform and buy the replacement property.
Right.
One of the real, well, probably the biggest problem with reverse exchanges is that you haven't closed on your relinquished property before you have to perform or buy your replacement property. So where are the funds going to come from? Either it comes out of your hip pocket if you have a lot of money, or you might have to get some kind of financing, in this case, bridge financing. And depending on the eccentricities of the deal, you might be able to get hard money. You might be able to get a second on the relinquished property if it isn't fully levered.
Oh, so you can actually...
So you basically put a lien on both your relinquished property and your replacement property. And then when you sell the relinquished property, a substantial portion of that loan gets paid off.
Okay.
Now, the caveat, and that is you cannot own your relinquished property and your replacement property at the same time.
So what does exactly that mean as far as like at the closing table, I close on my relinquished property first, then turn around and sign the other paper? Like what exactly does that mean?
What that means is for all intents and purposes, it used to be that we would look at the eccentricities of the deal and we decide which one of the properties are we going to own. Well, in the current financing environment that we have, we're in a situation where no lender wants to have our intermediate title holder, called an exchange accommodation title holder, on the paperwork. I'm giving you more gobbledygook.
Yeah.
The lender does not want our EAT, exchange accommodation title holder, on their paperwork. They want the borrower on that property. So we end up taking title to the relinquished property using this EAT, exchange accommodation title holder. So then what happens is we hold it, that property, for them. There's a lot of paperwork that we do on a deal like this.
I mean, sorry to interrupt you. Does that mean actually basically like the property closes and you get it, then you close again when you give it to the next party? Like what's the,
well,
when you take, I guess.
Well, in this case where the purchaser is actually taking title in their own name, We only take title in name only to this deal. And when they sell their relinquished property, we are on title as the seller.
Okay.
And then we bank the funds for the client for a short time and then use the funds to pay off a portion of the replacement property. It kind of makes people's brains explode.
Yeah, I'm following with you, but not all the details. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, absolutely.
But that's why we hire people like you, because you know the details.
Right. And we give you, through a lease, control of the property. So you don't lose control of the property. We are just on title in name only.
Okay.
This is all dictated by the IRS and a ruling that basically set the boundaries for reverse exchanges probably more than 10 years ago now. But it's a very useful tool. It's far more expensive because we are way more involved and we have a potential risk position in holding title to your relinquished property because we're on title for a time on this property. So, and then there's a certain education factor that goes on for everybody who's involved in the transaction. Our taxpayer, two title companies, lenders, you know, it just, it's a lot, it gets complicated. Yeah, it's a juggling factor.
So what does it cost, just say like your, you know, your typical normal exchange, or what would you, I guess a forward exchange, because we, what would be that before exchange, that official title?
I call it a simple forward exchange.
A simple forward exchange. So the one we've been talking about most of the time that, you know, people are familiar with, what's that basic cost to the investor?
Well, we charge $650 to do a simple forward exchange. So that's sell one, sell first, sell one property, buy one replacement property.
Okay.
That's it.
That seems really, really cheap.
Well, we've got our procedures down. Yeah. We do a good job for our clients. We've done a ton of these deals, and we think that's a fair price.
Look, I'm not complaining about it being cheap. I think I just expected a lot more, because it seems like there's a lot more you're doing, but that's cool. So if I sell one property, buy two properties, is it $650 or to go up?
We charge $350 for each additional replacement property.
Okay.
And that's because it's another closing that we have to go through.
Oh, yeah.
And the wire out process is fraught with potential difficulties in the current environment with wire fraud and that kind of thing. And we have to be very careful about getting the funds to the next closing. So we have costs involved in additional transactions like that.
Now, what's your typical reverse exchange cost?
Reverse exchanges, we charge $5,000 for.
Okay.
And that is, again, because of the intricate handling and the education process that we have to go through for multiple different parties who are privy to this transaction. So, and then, of course, the risk, potential risk that we have of holding title for a time to our relinquished property.
So if an investor out there wants to do 1031, you know, wants to sell, just say sell one property and buy one or two more, so a simple forward exchange, when should they start talking to you or another QI? At what point?
That's a great question, because I hate this call when it comes in, when somebody says, I just closed. I want to do my exchange. We may be able to help you if you haven't banked the funds, but if you've banked the funds, I can't help you. So please contact me before you close on anything. So if you think you're going to do a reverse, contact me before you close on your replacement property. If you think you're going to do a forward exchange, for sure contact me before you close on your relinquished property, because you have to have an exchange in place before you close. Otherwise, the cat's out of the bag. Again, we've done quite a number of these where the client luckily has the check and they haven't deposited. So we can usually get through that and cover our tracks and make sure everything's fine. But I like to know, give me a week, you know, a warning to do an exchange.
So they only need to contact you if they list the property, wait till the last minute. Closing is
when as soon as they get under contract and they have a closer, send me an email or contact my company and say, I'm going to sell property XYZ and Susie Q is going to be doing my closing for me.
Okay.
And that way we have an individual we can come to and say, all right, Fred Jones is doing an exchange. We're the accommodator or QI, qualified intermediary, in this transaction. And what we need is a copy of the contract and a copy of the title commitment. Armed with that, we can draft our paperwork and communicate with the title company as to what's going on and how we would like the transaction to be run with them.
Okay.
And then get, usually by email, copies of everything to our client for e-signature. We've come a long way in 25 years. We used to send out exchange packages by mail.
A little easier than FedExing stuff back and forth,
oh,
huh?
Boy. I do not miss those days.
So I'm looking at my list of questions here, and I think I asked you all of them. Is there anything I missed or final thoughts that you want to just share with our listeners out there before we wrap things up?
Yes. You know, one thing that sets us apart from title companies, Chris, is that we are willing to do reverse exchanges. The other thing that we can do for our clients, and we spoke briefly about this before, but I'm going to delve into this, and that is what we call an equity equalization loan.
Yes. What is that?
Okay. So let's go back to the $1 million example.
Okay.
Although we never talked about the debt on that deal, whether there was any debt on that deal. So let's say that it was a... Well, let's just say that there's no debt. It's an all-cash deal. And the client has decided, you know, I really like real estate, and my real estate agent has explained to me the virtues of debt in doing transactions. It allows me to use somebody else's money and juice my return by borrowing money at, I'm going to say 4%, 4.5%, and then go after a return of something approaching around 7%. Mm-hmm. That seems like a pretty good deal to me. So in the example where we talked about the client selling a $1 million property, let's say that they want to buy a $1.2 million property.
Okay.
And let's say that they need only $300,000 down on that property, because that's 25%.
Right.
So they really only need to have $300,000 carried forward in their exchange to have the down on their replacement property.
Right. I follow you.
But if they were to sell that property as it stands right now, they would sell it for $1 million, and I would bank their essentially $1 million for them. And by rule, they would be required to trade equal or up, or actually use all of their net proceeds, in this case, $1 million. So they have this $1 million, or a substantial portion of their $1 million, trapped in this transaction. By doing an equity equalization loan and encumbering this property before they sell, two things will happen. The loan will get paid off. The loan gets paid off, and net of our fee, which is 1% or $500, they will get that $750,000 back as loan proceeds, non-taxable, and only have to carry forward the $250,000 that they need as the down on their next property. They've effectively liberated $750,000 in cash that have no strings attached to it.
So this is a loan on the property I'm on selling?
On the relinquished property, the property that are selling.
So I think I follow you, but I'm going to repeat it back to make sure. So I take out a loan of $700,000, let's say, on that property. Mm-hmm. And then when it's time to sell, the proceeds, $700,000 go off to pay the loan. $300,000 goes to you to bank to use for my next property.
The loan proceeds go to my lending company that has created this loan for you. Then net of our fees, so in this case, 1% of $750,000, that's $7,000 to do that deal. So then I will wire transfer to you $693,000 in loan proceeds to you, non-taxable. And you carry forward in your example, the other 300 into the next transaction.
Interesting.
It's an incredibly powerful tool.
So why would someone do that versus buy the new property for cash, refinance, and pull the money out?
Well, that can be...
Or is there something, is one better than the other, or is it, you know, six, half a dozen type thing? Like, because I understand what you're saying. I'm just trying to understand, you know, all the options out there and how this all works.
Well, when you refinance a property, you have to pay an appraisal fee.
Mm-hmm.
You pay points, you pay loan fees, that kind of thing, that are for sure going to add up to a lot more than 1%, which is my fee.
Okay. Okay. That
so makes this sense. Is the path of least resistance for you. It's far more expedient and it gets the job done, which is it gives you tax-free cash and gets money into the next transaction and you're down the road.
And basically. The IRS is all good with this.
Yeah.
Wow.
It doesn't come without some small tax risk, but
okay.
I've done a lot of these for people and no one's been called on the carpet yet. My partner did a transaction himself involving sale of the office building where we were located and then traded into our new location. And he got a $300,000 equity equalization loan and he used it to make repairs on the building, his new building where we occupy. So we've had a lot of people use these.
So that's called equity equalization loan. I've never heard that phrase before.
That's because that's our phrase. Maybe we ought to trademark it.
Yeah. So that's your company's phrase. That's not like the common. Okay.
No, it's not. Okay. I've used a lot of IRS gobbledygook, but that's not one of them.
So Chris, who can act as a QI? Is it anyone that's just not the seller, or do you have to be a certain designation? Like who can just bank the money for the person and be that, like, you know, I'll say the trustee, for lack of a better word?
Well, Chris, it can't be anybody who you have a prior relationship with. So it can't be your brother, your brother-in-law, your friend, your business associate, your realtor, your accountant, your attorney. Those are all disqualified people in this transaction. The only individuals who are allowed to act as QI that you have a prior relationship with would be a situation where you've done business with the same title company for a long time. And it's because title companies have more lobbying money to, you know, insinuate themselves in this type of transaction and act as QI. The thing is that title companies are, in essence, insurance companies, and they are in large part reticent to give or unwilling to give advice about transactions. And we give advice all the time because we know that's a valuable piece of what we provide besides our simple escrow service and a successful transmission of your funds to the next transaction.
So to kind of go lawyer on the word relationship, I'm using air quotes for the listeners out there, like what defines a relationship? So, I mean, like you and I have met, we've had a cup of coffee, we know each other now. Is that a relationship where I can't use you a year from now? Like what defines a relationship?
If you were to hire me, you would hire my company to do your 1031. I wouldn't personally be doing your exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So that allows you to be able to do business with me since you already know me.
So it's that. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
So obviously there are a lot of details and rules on this and you know all of them. How can people get in touch with you or learn more if they want to, you know, do a 1031 with you? What's the best way to get in touch with you?
Okay. So there are a number of ways. First and foremost, we're called 1031x.com. I like that because it's pretty easy to remember. It's 1031 x4exchange.com, and it's only 5 characters, so I like that because I've never been able to type very well anyway, so you know, and that was back from the Amazon days that I got that URL. Then locally here in Denver, you can reach us at 303-504-0144. We have an 800 number, which is a lot slicker, and that's 888-899-1031.
Ooh, that's a nice one.
I like that one. And if you want to use that locally, I don't care, you know, because we don't seem to get charged for those calls anymore, which is very nice. Then, of course, you can send me an email. And the easy email for me is Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at 1031thelletterx.com. On Twitter, we are at 1031x. dotcom, so 1031x.com, spelled out. On LinkedIn, we're LinkedIn.
If it's an ugly URL, I can put that in the show notes.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, so
it involves my first and last name and a one, and you know, so
I think the email, the website, and the phone number are. I know what most people use, but if you send me over the LinkedIn other profiles, I'll put those in the show notes and also website, phone numbers, email, Twitter, and all that as well. So people can, because, you know, people, since they're out driving, walking their dogs.
Yeah, I don't want anybody having any accidents trying to write stuff down.
No. So I'll put all that in the show notes. Chris, thank you so much for doing this episode with us. I learned a lot, and I'm pretty sure a lot of our listeners will learn a lot too. And I just appreciate it. So thank you.
Thanks for having me, Chris. It's been a pleasure.